Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the nomination of Merrick Garland, the Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals, to fill the vacant seat on the Supreme Court following the death of Justice Scalia. Dahlia Lithwick, a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she writes the column Supreme Court Dispatches and hosts the Amicus podcast, joins us. We will discuss whether, when Judge Merrick does the rounds on Capitol Hill tomorrow, Republican senators who previously praised Merrick will lock their doors and hide under their desks, refusing to even shake hands with him, let alone give him a hearing, then allow a vote on his nomination. Then we will speak with Tiziana Deering, a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston. An anti-poverty activist and advocate for social justice, we will discuss her article at CNN, The Confusion That Is Driving Support for Donald Trump, and determine whether a moral case against a racist, misogynist, bigot espousing hatred and division will have any traction amongst Trump's followers in this highly polarized and overheated election season. Then finally, we will look into concerns expressed by Israel's president in a meeting in Moscow with President Putin that Russia's sudden exit from Syria will create a dangerous void in that war-torn country. Dr. Guy Ziv, a professor at American University School of International Service and the director of the Israel National Security Project, joins us to discuss Prime Minister Netanyahu's upcoming trip to Moscow to meet with Putin and how Israelis view the possibility of a Trump presidency, given that Trump has canceled the presidential candidates' debate on Fox News to instead speak before the pro-Israel lobby AIPAC. And joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, who's a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she writes the column Supreme Court Dispatches and hosts the Amicus podcast. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland, who's the chief judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals, of course, has been, the door is already shut in terms of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, but it looks as though there is a tactic on the part of the president, perhaps to shame. I'm not sure that you can shame the shameless, but I guess it's worth a shot. What's your sense?
I think that's exactly right. I think this was, you know, probably flies in the face of what Obama would have preferred to do, which is make a historic pick. You know, he could have put another African-American, the first African-American woman on the court. He could have put the first Hindu justice on the court, all sorts of people on the short list that might have been more in keeping with his view of what he wants the court to look like, more so than a 63-year-old white man. But I think he made the decision as a political calculation to do exactly what you said. I think he wants to box in Republicans who confirmed the same Merrick Garland when Clinton put him up for the 19 years ago for the Court of Appeals, who said over and over again that he was a moderate, temperate pick. I think he specifically probably wants to shame Orrin Hatch, Senator Hatch, who only recently said, well, if Obama wanted to be reasonable, he could give us someone like Merrick Garland, but he's not going to be reasonable. So I think these are all efforts to impeach GOP opponents who are saying no hearing, not even a vote, won't even have a meeting, and to say this is a guy who you held out as the reasonable, moderate compromise.
Well, apparently when Obama, just before he picked Justice Kagan for the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland was high on the list, and that was a name that was run by Orrin Hatch and others, and he expressed a great deal of interest in Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court at that time over Kagan, and the president's calculus was supposed to be that he was saving Garland for when things got even more difficult, which they clearly are now. Is that a part of the history here?
It is certainly a part of the history. I think Obama took a very hard look at Merrick Garland for the seat that was vacated by Justice John Paul Stevens. And I think that he made the determination that he could go out on a limb a little bit and pick someone who, you know, he was very close to, longstanding friendship, and somebody who he really believed in that would be a legacy pick. You know, Elena was going to be a woman, and I think it was was important to him to do that, I think he probably felt, and it is well known, that Merrick Garland is as much a moderate center left jurist. He's got 19 years of experience on the federal appeals court. This is not somebody who's going to be a whole bunch of surprise. And he really probably is thinking at some level, look, if there is a single human being that I can put up that they could tolerate, this must be him. And I think you're quite right in saying at the outset that I suspect, certainly based on the reaction in the last few hours, that this is not going to be seen as a compromise candidate. And in fact, I just heard a really terrific quote on Fox News where somebody said, I believe this is a trap to make Obama look reasonable. And I thought that's the problem. You know, even when he's being reasonable, it's seen as some kind of gimme.
Well, the thing that I don't understand, though, Dahlia Lithwick, is if this is dead on arrival, as Mitch McConnell suggests, Judge Garland himself, of course, was in the Rose Garden at the ceremony with his wife. Apparently, she's the granddaughter of a presidential counsel and well known in sort of Washington circles or judicial circles, I guess. So why are they all going along with it? I mean, you don't raise people's hopes falsely, do you, surely?
Well, I think this is just really complicated, and I think in the coming days we're going to understand an awful lot more about what the thinking was here. I think it's really early. I think that there was, you know, certainly a feeling that you know, on the one hand, Obama had a chance to do something very, very dramatic that would have been, you know, a legacy-making pick. I think that on the other hand, and this kind of tells you that Obama, when he presents as someone really cautious and really prudent, that's because he is really cautious and really prudent. He made the safe, non-historic choice. And also, I think it's important to say, if you think about this nomination as something that was meant to galvanize voters, put the Supreme Court on the menu in the 2016 election, make a lot of people angry, there is nobody who is going to be really, really angry that Obama's picked a 63-year-old man and he can't get confirmed. So there was a lot of constituencies that had very high hopes that the first Asian American justice was going to be tapped, that you know, he was going to pick, you know, any number of things that would have really, really galvanized his base. And in a strange sense, he did the opposite of that. He put all of those hopes and dreams of everybody aside and said, I'm going to pick the guy either that I can get confirmed or that is going to make GOP obstructionists in the Senate look terrible.
And again, I'm speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who's a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she writes the column Supreme Court Dispatches and hosts the Amicus podcast. So when the head of the Senate, the Republican leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, refers to the Biden rule, I mean, you got to give them points for, I guess, for trying to sort of shift the blame, if you will, that this is all happening because of Biden and Biden's rule, when it's pretty clear that this is pretty unprecedented and pretty naked partisanship to hold up a nominee for almost a year and to operate on a divided Supreme Court, which where many, many cases are going to be hung in the balance and then have to be kicked back to the lower court, which will where the ruling will stand. And that doesn't sound like the right way to run a railroad, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that it's certainly fair to say, and I think that both sides can concede that both sides play this game and that Democrats have historically obstructed GOP nominees and GOP's, you know, senators have obstructed Democrat nominees. So, you know, we can go back as we've been doing and tweet about what happened in the last 16 years or the last 40 years or the last 80 years. But it is certainly the case that the Senate has operated according to certain norms and certain rules. And one of those norms and rules has been that you give the guy a hearing and you give him or her an up and down vote. So the notion that 1 hour after Justice Scalia's death, the claim was being made that we will never even have a hearing. We're not even going to acknowledge that this is going on because this is a, quote, lame duck president, even though he has a year left in his presidency. That really is unprecedented. So I think it's fair to say that both sides have tried to obstruct the other side's judges. But as recently as the seating of Anthony Kennedy, you can see that somebody was seated in an election year because the Democrats just said at the end of the day, we can't hold this entire process hostage. So it seems to me that this is kind of a whole new level of obstruction. And really then the question becomes whether this is going to get any kind of resonance and saliency with the voters come November, whether they're going to see this as, you know, a really, really defining, galvanizing issue, or they're going to say, like, you know, I never really got it about the court. I didn't care all that much, and I'm not going to get exercised about this now.
But do you think tomorrow, when Judge Garland goes up to the Hill to meet with some senators, will we have optics of him knocking on doors and and the Republican senators refusing to open the door? I mean,
right, or hiding under their desk?
Right.
Can you imagine? Just, you know, the optics are going to be terrible, and that was, I think, exactly Obama's plan. Is that I think he really said, this is a person that you held out, Orrin Hatch, as someone reasonable. I've given you someone reasonable, and you're not even going to shake his hand. So I think you're quite right. The optics will be terrible. But bear in mind, this is an election like none we have ever witnessed in this country. The electorate is clearly angry, and it's hard to tell whether they're really going to be motivated for months and months and months about a Supreme Court vacancy. I mean, this is not something that the left typically is very energized about. I think the political right in this country is much more organized and energized around the composition of the court. And so it's going to require, I think, an almost daily drumbeat. I think in a weird sense, Merrick Garland almost has to become some version of Hillary Clinton's vice presidential candidate and has to stump around for the next year and be a symbol of obstructionism. And that's a really, really unhappy position for any serious jurist to be in. And it's really going to be, I think, a question of how long the voters are going to really, really care and rally and think about this obstruction, or whether this is just going to look like one more piece of partisan politics in a government that's already so fundamentally broken.
Well, that's, of course, the problem is that we're in all of these kind of truth-free zones here, and it's not a question of reason and rationality winning the argument, because the truth is a moving target, and whoever spins it the best wins the argument. And you would think that the complete inconsistencies of the Republican arguments would be quite plain to all to see, where they say, no, we've got to, this is an important decision that only the next president can make. Well, on the Republican side, the next president is likely to be Donald Trump. And frankly, the Republicans themselves are very uncertain and unsettled by that possibility in itself. So, and this is a man, Donald Trump, who has advocated torture and has apparently a very cavalier attitude to the law, much as he's studied it, which is very little, I think, except in terms of all the people that sued him. So, I mean, will the American people find that argument hollow, or are you, as you just said, is it just such a overheated partisan year that it doesn't matter?
Well, I think I have two responses. One is, to the extent that the past primary season has been a referendum on anything, it's that the establishment, the Republican establishment, has utterly lost control of the party. And one of the things I think you're going to see play out now is that same Republican establishment, which is very, very good at organizing around the courts. You know, think about, the campaign finance groups, think about the gun groups, think about the pro-life groups. They are immediately in lockstep behind the senators who want to block this nomination. And so it seems to me that a lot of the energy that has sort of drained out of the presidential race has leached very, very, very quickly into this conversation about the court seat. In, I guess, the simplest way I would say it is, I suspect that the GOP establishment, which is in peril of losing the executive branch, is going to hang on to the court with a sort of double tenacity. But I think the other thing that's important, and this is just my sense based on early polling of even Republican voters who say by, I think, about a 2-to-1 margin, that this obstruction that we're seeing around the court seat is a bridge too far. And what we're hearing a lot of is the court is just different. Even in an era of just epic, eye-glazing political, you know, brinksmanship and ugliness, and I would go so far as to say nihilism, that the court is different, and it's different by design. And Americans have a special reverence for the court. There's a reason that they weren't out with, you know, blazing, flaming pitchforks after Bush v. Gore, or after Citizens United, or after Shelby County, the case that gutted the heart of the Voting Rights Act. It's that even when we disagree with the court, I think in a deep way, it's kind of our secular church. And I do believe that the reason even Republican senators in closely fought states are a little nervous about this piece of obstruction is that when it comes to government, I believe that the judicial branch is still perceived as different and as apolitical insofar as it can be apolitical, and that that's something that folks may want to fight for. So that's just rank speculation on my part, but I do think that polling suggests that when Americans look at the justice system, they think, the court's a little different.
Well, just in closing, Dahlia Lithwick, some of the vulnerable Republicans, of course, are very much, Obama is putting them in a bit of a vice. Rob Portman in Ohio, for example, and Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania are not in great shape. So, but you mentioned also that the Democrats basically are probably going to hold on to the executive branch. Well, after all, that's the only branch they have. They haven't really controlled the judicial branch, it's at least in terms of the Supreme Court, with a 5-to-4 conservative majority. They don't control the House and don't control the Senate. One of the concerns that Republicans have, and the so-called establishment, whatever's left of it, has, is that Donald Trump will have a devastating down-ticket effect. So, again, it's a strange thing. Here you've got Donald Trump saying, we're never going to entertain anybody that Obama sends up to fill this vacancy if Scalia's. And at the same time, you've got these vulnerable senators, and you've got the bigger issue, whether a Trump presidency will, in fact, result in a down-ticket devastation that will give the Democrats not only the White House but also the Senate.
I think that's the real fear, and that's where you're going to see even Chuck Grassley, Kelly Ayotte, Ron Johnson, you know, people who are in close-fought Senate races who are going to have to go home and explain to their constituents why they wouldn't even get out from under their desks and shake Merrick Garland's hand, why they did that. And it's possible, as I said, that their, you know, electorate doesn't care, or the electorate is already so polarized around the courts that they'll be glad for this. But it does seem to me that the possibility of losing the Senate increases when you're being this obstructive. And one other piece of this that's probably worth flagging is at the end of the day, if you look at Obama's popularity ratings, which seem to go up every day as Donald Trump's numbers go up, I do think in some sense this is a referendum on this president. And if you think about the fact that the messaging out of the Republicans in the Senate is he's not the real president. The last year of his presidency doesn't even count because he's not for real. I do think that that may have a real impact even on the down ballot races. I think that people are starting to look around and say, you know, compared to some of what we're seeing in these primaries, Obama may not have been all that bad. And in that sense, I think Obama's tactical decision to put up somebody who really, by every metric, is a moderate and a consensus candidate is exactly as reasonable as Obama himself is. And you may see some kind of sense in the electorate that oh my God, you know, we had a grown-up president put up a grown-up nominee, and this was obstructed. Why? And that's how it may play out.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who's a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, where she writes the column Supreme Court Dispatches and hosts the Amicus podcast. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether a moral case against a racist, misogynist bigot espousing hatred and division will have any traction amongst Trump's followers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Tiziana Dearing, who is a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston, an anti-poverty activist and advocate for social justice. She has an article at CNN, The Confusion That Is Driving Support for Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tiziana Dearing.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And I was thinking, just, you know, your article, of course, came out before last night's primaries, which were fairly decisive in many ways.
Yeah.
Propelling Donald Trump closer to the nomination, and likewise for Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. But my sense is that prior to that vote yesterday, that it could have been in some ways construed as a referendum on America itself, in the sense that will the American people reward Donald Trump for his bad behavior, or will they punish him for the outbursts of racism and thuggery at his rallies? So is that your sense, that not only are we talking about this election in terms of who's up and who's down, but where the American people are in terms of our better angels?
Yeah, I do think that there's a dynamic going on there as well. And I think in part it comes back to this concept of the social contract, kind of different perceptions of what we think we owe each other. I heard one of the commentators last night during the coverage refer to both Trump and Sanders as grievance candidates, people you vote for or support if you have a grievance. And if, in fact, what's motivating you in this election is grievance, then you're not so worried about manners, as people who are feeling stuck on the outside rarely are. And I think that's part of the phenomenon that we're seeing here. I find it deeply, deeply troubling. I think civil discourse is essential to democracy, but it certainly seems to be a factor in this race.
But there is a fundamental difference between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, not just the political one in the sense that one is on the left and the other one is nominally on the right. But Bernie Sanders has identified what he thinks are the problems in terms of those with legitimate grievances about trade outsourcing. And his refrain is, you know, people have been working longer hours for less for the last 30 years, and America hasn't had a raise in 30-plus years. Donald Trump, on the other hand, is extremely vague about what his solutions are, even though he diagnoses some of the same problems. So what would explain the appeal of one person who is able to capture these grievances but not offer a real solution beyond, you know, just slogans, if you will, and the other person who seems at least to have some solutions, albeit not, you know, in great detail? But I'm confused about that, needless to say.
I think it's exactly the right question. And I think for those of us in particular who look for public policy discussions, public policy suggestions, what Trump is offering is a really probably a pretty unsatisfying recipe. But what is interesting is that as Bernie Sanders is really being quite clear on his reform approaches to public policy, I would argue that part of Trump's appeal to his supporters is that he's actually offering a pretty clear agenda of some kind of cultural reform, that he is really drawing out a sense of, I want to be able to say things I'm not allowed to say anymore. I want America to be tough and have a standing I don't feel like America has anymore. I want things that are scary to just stop and go away, and I want someone who's going to promise that they will. And so while Trump is not being specific in ways that are satisfying to people who are looking for public policy solutions, I actually think he's been culturally quite specific about what he's offering and what he's telling people he stands for.
And again, I'm speaking with Tatiana Deering, who's a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston, an anti-poverty activist and advocate for social justice. She has an article at CNN, The Confusion That Is Driving Support for Trump. But when you say cultural issues, in many ways, that's almost euphemistic for the fact that it's pretty clear to me and a lot of people that Donald Trump, by using this catchphrase, political correctness, which also Dr. Ben Carson railed against, that seems to be a sort of cover, if you will, for giving people permission to express racist hostilities to minorities and Muslims and others that heretofore was considered, you know, politically correct, I guess. So it seems to me that that's inescapable in this race, that as I mentioned earlier, it's really, it seems to be a question between the dark side and our better angels.
It's interesting. A lot of people who have emailed me about my piece on CNN have talked about the dark side and the light side. You know, I think this is I think we're talking about an existential level of concern about what's happening in this election. Ian, this idea of political correctness, I've been thinking a lot about this the last few days, and I think you're raising something that is so important. I think we forget that there are continua, right? And, you know, there's a continuum of things that you say out loud and things that you say in your head and things you wish you didn't even think. And I think there are plenty of things on that continuum that are things that people say in their heads only or wish they didn't even think that are just good judgment to not have come out of your mouth. It's not about political correctness. It's about being a decent human being. And it concerns me that we have conflated thought policing with, no, I'm just asking you to be a decent human being and maybe keep that in your head or potentially try not to think it in the future. I think it's really concerning that we've labeled decency as political correctness. It's licensed to just do things that are and say things that are destabilizing to be in community with each other.
But in terms of decency, John Kasich's acceptance speech for his win in Ohio was quite clear in terms of advocating for decency, gave all kinds of examples of things that we should do to our fellow human beings. It was almost like a Sunday school lesson. On the other hand, Donald Trump he started his campaign out by making outrageous statements about Latinos. He's closed the door on Muslims and said pretty outrageous things about Muslims. My concern is that as a public figure and a potential, he certainly looks like the Republican nominee at this point and could even be the president of the United States. Contrast that with Barack Obama in terms of bringing this country together and those in this country who have been disadvantaged. For example, young African-American kids were absolutely inspired by Obama's election as president of the United States. On the other hand, by saying nasty things about minorities such as Muslims and Latinos, you're crushing the spirits of young Latinos and Muslims rather than raising them up. And to my mind, you know, that's what the real issue is here. Is Donald Trump going to be held accountable for what he said? Because words from authority figures can be both uplifting and they can also be equally hurtful. And my sense is that the more he becomes closer to the nomination, the more legitimized he will be by both the Republican Party and by the press, and all of these horrible things will be forgotten, if not forgiven.
You know, I think it's important to have the distinction between forgotten and forgiven, A. B, the legitimacy is already happening. I mean, if you go back to last summer, there were news outlets that really literally would not even cover his candidacy because they couldn't take it seriously. because they felt that he was the entertainment option in the race. Huffington Post at one point would not cover Donald Trump in its politics section because they didn't consider him a legitimate politician. So the legitimacy that you're talking about, I think that horse has left the barn already, and he's already been given the legitimacy as the leading candidate. I think many people have been watching in dismay as his insurgence has happened, thinking that there are going to be consequences at some point for the things that he said, the behavior, and frankly, the inaccuracy, the lack of factualness in the things that he said. And yet, over and over again, that accountability hasn't been there. On the flip side, I think it's important to remember that he has, on average, won fewer than about 40% of the vote among registered Republicans, which, by the way, is the smallest party. There's about 20% of Americans, a little bit less than that, who are registered as Republicans. So we're really talking about 40% of the 20%. And as we move into the general election, we're also talking about a much larger body of Americans with strong opinions and the ability to be able to create accountability. Part of this is the function of our extremely polarized primary system.
Well, those indications are clear that he's a minority of a minority party, and the biggest constituency in the United States is our independents by a considerable margin over both Democrats and Republicans. But it is also equally clear that Donald Trump is bringing out independents and the so-called Reagan Democrats, and that there is an enthusiasm gap, if you will, where more and more Republicans are voting and not as many Democrats are voting, although there was a big turnout in Illinois yesterday. So something is happening there. You cannot suggest that Donald Trump is a flash in the pan. He's been written off so many times. And by the way, the Huffington Post had to sort of reconsider their idea of banishing him to the entertainment pages. They do have a little addendum at the end of all stories reminding us that he's a racist and all this.
They have quite the disclaimer at the end of any of their stories about him.
Exactly. But I'm not sure how effective that is. But I think it's, again, he could actually, even though we're in early days now, he could be a formidable candidate. And nobody can suggest that Hillary Clinton is catching the electorate on fire.
No, and you know, that's the other thing that's come into play here. We haven't talked about it as much recently. I heard it talked about earlier in the race more, which is we also just have whether or not somebody is a good candidate, right? And Hillary Clinton, one of her weaknesses has been people don't love her as a candidate. And, you know, you said yourself, sort of energizing people or not energizing people. People who are turning out for Donald Trump like him as a candidate. And this is one part that he's a charismatic guy at the podium. And it's also one part that we have conflated entertainment with pretty much everything else in America at this point. And I'm going to sound like a grumpy old woman for saying so, but we prioritize being entertained over most things in our culture anymore. So the entertaining candidate is the one people flock to. And this is a guy who has been in the entertainment business for decades. And it affects his quality as a candidate. Sometimes I think we have too much of a big gap, Ian, between what makes a good candidate and what would make a good president.
Well, but there's also, I think, I've been getting angry emails from supporters from Donald Trump basically saying I'm a liberal elitist, and, you know, that's a pretty easy label to apply. But there is an element, I think, of elitism in all of us. I mean, I personally don't find the Kardashians interesting, but a lot of people do, you know. Mm-hmm. So how do you navigate through that? Is there, you know, just I'm just responding to emails from people who are Trump supporters who basically say, you know, you're just a bunch of liberal elitists who are dismissing us. He's our guy and to hell with you, you know. And I think what there is in that anger is a sense that we like what we like, and you guys are, you know, may like, you're reading the New York Review of Books and going to ballet recitals, but to hell with you.
Yeah, you know, and I believe me, I get those notes too, right? I'm in New England. We're supposed to be the bastion of the liberal elite. But I think, and I feel like it's something that you touched on earlier, I think that there can be a difference between liberal and conservative and kind of off the charts. And listen, There are themes to some of what Donald Trump is saying that are populist themes that I think a lot of people understand, right? And I really do believe that each candidate offers insights and windows into things that are making everybody anxious. I said in my CNN piece, you know, no matter where you are in the country is going to hell in a handbasket. You're just looking at different baskets, right? We do need to acknowledge that. But reasonable people could come together to discuss those problems and even look at policy options that are on a continuum from conservative to liberal without having to go to the kind of angry political fundamentalism that I think we're seeing from the Trump podium that is quite different and that is just not consistent with solving problems together in a democracy. And wanting people to be able to solve problems together in a democracy doesn't actually make you liberal elite. There's got to be some distance between what he's doing and being liberal. And other candidates such as Kasich and Cruz and Rubio have been trying to occupy that space.
But there is this extraordinary component of religion in terms of the religious right and the fact that evangelicals are voting for him in greater numbers than they are for an authentic evangelical. At least Ted Cruz's father is a Dominionist, as a matter of fact. And that raises a certain amount of puzzlement. And my sense is that, you know, obviously the religious right and the evangelicals are better politically organized and have a louder voice, and the religious left is pretty ill-defined. There were periods in this country where you had a religious left with William Jennings Bryan voting against, you know, he was up against the plutocrats at the turn of the 20th century. I've always been puzzled by that, by why it is, particularly when we have this discussion, as we are, about the dark side and the better angels. Isn't this time for the religious left to step up? And I guess, you know, arguably they have better ammunition in terms of the authentic example of the prophet Jesus. He didn't carry an AK-47. He didn't hate homosexuals. He didn't make vile racist statements, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the dynamics that happened a couple of months ago, I guess now, in the race was when there was the exchange back and forth between Pope Francis and Donald Trump. And one of the things that has been interesting with the emergence of Pope Francis, who is a Catholic leader, yes, but has polls have demonstrated and international behavior has demonstrated has a broader appeal beyond just the Catholic faith. One might argue that he's the most visible representative on the planet right now of what you would have termed sort of liberal, what was the term? Not the religious right, the religious left,
Left,
and in many ways, he's become a symbol of what could be a religious left. I wonder if he had a few more years of traction under his belt, if there would have been a different way for him to engage in a dialogue about teachings of faith and political positions. Now, there's always going to be a question, and we have a strong tradition in the United States of not wanting a papacy to interfere with American political practice. And I understand that. But we have not had a religious left visible leader. And in the United States, we've had more than 20 years of very smart, savvy organizing on the side of the religious right, really all the way back to 92, 94, right? And staying strong back from the days of Ralph Reed on. So we're not, the religious left is not organized in the same way and has lacked visible leaders in the way that the religious right has.
Well, that could also be extended in a way to the political left. I mean, we've had a community organizer in the White House, and he swept in on a huge majority. But that hasn't been, that movement has not been sustained as a political movement. And it's very interesting to note that Donald Trump's campaign team are all from the Koch brothers, many of whom, including Corey Lewandowski, his head of his campaign, did all of the organizing to organize and fund the Tea Party, which is very much the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party. So they have been extremely successful. So that's another paradox to my mind.
Well, it is. You know, I've been studying this year in my work in my academic life. I've been part of a seminar that's studying income inequality. And in looking across all the different kinds of research on income inequality, one thing that's quite interesting is political voice directly correlates with income, meaning that public interest is much more tied to high-income communities and their political wants and needs than low-income and middle-income voters, even when you control for all kinds of behaviors. So whether people are voting or not, whether they're politically active or not, voice correlates with money. And so when you look at an emergent campaign like Trump, and there's a strong correlation in his own personal life as well as in the lives of his staffers around money involved in political interests, that's not that surprising, because the data shows that is simply the case now in the United States.
Well, Tiziana Dearing, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to talk with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Tiziana Dearing, who's a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston, an anti-poverty activist and advocate for social justice. She has an article at CNN, The Confusion That Is Driving Support for Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into concerns expressed by Israel's president in a meeting in Moscow with President Putin that Russia's sudden exit from Syria will create a dangerous void.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
מפנה מקום בלב ללחיצות שלך, מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך. אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Guy Ziv, who's a professor at the American University School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project, an online repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict. He is the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel, and has a recent article at CNN, Don't Give Up on a Two-State Solution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Guy Ziv.
Thank you.
And with Israel's president in Moscow meeting with Vladimir Putin, marking the 25th anniversary of diplomatic ties between the two countries, Putin and he discussed the idea of having UN peacekeepers return to the tense area on the Golan Heights between Israel and Syria. And it's also reported that Prime Minister Netanyahu will soon be heading to Moscow to meet with Putin. Apparently there's concerns in Israel about Russia's pullout from Syria, that it will leave a dangerous void. And I recall, in fact, when Putin first, just before he deployed in Syria, I think the first phone call he made was to Netanyahu. So is Israel concerned about Russia's pullout?
I think Israel would like to coordinate its efforts with Russia, since it's a key stakeholder there. The Israelis were caught off guard half a year ago or 5 months ago when Russia decided to intervene in Syria, and they were caught off guard again the other day when Russia unexpectedly decided to pull out. And for Israel, you know, the concern is pretty obvious. Syria is in the midst of a civil war. It's bordering Israel. It could be spillover effects, and there has been already some spillover effects to a small extent. And Israel is worried not just about the jihadists, ISIS, and others. It's worried about the Assad government itself, which is a strong ally of Russia, and the oldest ally of Russia in the Middle East. Israel had managed to coordinate its plans with Russia back in October. The Russians agreed to basically give Israel the green light or the amber light to continue basically interfering in the deliveries of missiles and other arms from Iran to Hezbollah via Syria. So, you know, Israel has from time to time, periodically, bomb those areas, the delivery vehicles, and the Russians have basically allowed for Israel to do that. So they had some sort of mechanism in place, and the question was, how do they continue to communicate and coordinate efforts now that Russia is going to be gone? Because Israel is very concerned with the Assad regime, primarily with Iran and with Hezbollah.
Well, did these concerns extend to some of the reports we're getting out of Israel that Hezbollah has gained strength and valuable military expertise from its involvement in the Syrian conflict, where without Hezbollah's intervention and Iran's intervention and then subsequently Russia's intervention, I think it's pretty clear that Assad would have gone under. Is that a concern?
It's a big concern, but the biggest concern, I think, is not so much the war experience in Syria. It's simply that they have a very big arsenal of missiles, and it's just a question of when, not if, the next war between Israel and Hezbollah is going to take place. And so Israel wants to be fully prepared. Hezbollah has not denied its goal of trying to obliterate Israel, or at least cause major damage. And Hezbollah is typically on the number one list of enemies or adversaries that Israel faces today.
So what is your understanding of the real relationship then in this tripartite kind of arrangement where you have Russia propping up Assad, Iran propping up Assad, and I guess you could add Hezbollah, although they are pretty much an Iranian proxy?
That's right.
So we get the hints that Putin is pretty fed up with Assad, and one of the reasons perhaps that he pulled out was to, as these peace talks began, was to basically push Assad towards some kind of compromise, although we don't know. I think the safe bet is that the peace talks will probably go nowhere like all previous efforts have, but still, I think Putin was trying to give them a chance. What's your understanding about this dynamic between these so-called allies?
Well, I think that you spelled it out pretty accurately. Now, keep in mind, we don't really know what's in Putin's mind and why Putin did what he did. So we can only speculate. And I think that was the key reason for the president of Israel going there, to figure out, let's communicate here. Tell us what's going on and what do you have in mind. And then that will be followed up with a visit by Prime Minister Netanyahu at some point in the near future. I think that you can read it in different ways. According to Putin, he gave the kind of vague justification for withdrawing, saying we've achieved our goals, whatever that means. Now, that could mean that Assad is strong enough, secure enough, that perhaps they don't need the Russians. But it could also mean, as you suggested, that this would be a way to pressure Assad to perhaps compromise, something that Assad has not been willing to do up until now. And perhaps he is fed up with Assad, and perhaps this is his way of saying, we've tried, we've worked with you, you need to be more forthcoming here.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Guy Ziv, who's a professor at American University's School of International Service and the director of the Israel National Security Project. But prior to the Syrian civil war, it was my understanding that Israel was fairly sort of, I wouldn't say comfortable, but they could live with Assad, that they're much more afraid of the instability that's followed since the uprising against Assad. So has that always been the attitude? You know, he may be an SOB, but he's an SOB that we can live with.
I think there was a split within the political and security circles as to whether it's good or not good for Israel that all this is happening. And there were some that said, yeah, better the devil you know than you don't know, and better to have Assad, because at the very least, Assad has not violated any of the prior, you know, for example, the Israel-Syria disengagement accords of the 70s, and pretty much kept the peace there. On the other hand, you have others who say, no, Assad is actually... Israel would be better off without Assad, because Assad is very close to Hezbollah. He's the link between Iran and Hezbollah, and we want to break that link. So it depends who you ask. But in general, a vacuum would probably be the worst case scenario, because that's really what you have, fundamentalists and extremists of all stripes who exploit a vacuum. And that's probably going to happen if the Assad regime falls.
So let's turn then, Dr. Ghaziev, to the fact that you have, first of all, you're the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel, and you had a recent article at CNN, Don't Give Up on a Two-State Solution, and your national security project, the Israel National Security Project, is a repository of statements by Israeli security experts who favor a two-state solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And, of course, going back to the very beginning, it was, after all, people that I used to talk to years ago, like Yehoshua Fadakabi and others in the military intelligence, were the ones that started the two-state solution.
That's right. That's right.
For security reasons.
That's right.
Primarily. It's interesting that Donald Trump has just canceled his debate on Fox to speak it to AIPAC. And all we know about Donald Trump's attitudes to Israel in these debates have been that he wants to be the honest broker. He wants to be neutral. How's that going to fly in front of AIPAC?
Wow. Well, there's a big movement in the Jewish community, including many supporters of AIPAC, who to try to prevent Trump from speaking there, or at the very least to protest his presence there, because many in the Jewish community are uncomfortable with a Trump candidacy because they correctly, I think, view him as a demagogue and somebody who's kind of bringing out the worst in the American society. And I don't know if you could really see him as a credible mediator in Israeli Palestinian peace talks or any other any other conflict for that matter.
So when he says he wants to be a neutral party, I mean, that has been the criticism of why a lot of these talks have failed. You know, the accusations that that Dennis Ross was too close to Israel, et cetera, and that the U.S. hasn't been sufficiently neutral to really knock the heads together and to get this deal done, which, of course, has not gotten done. We know that, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's really been the reason that that you don't have peace today. It's very possible to be an honest broker and not be quote-unquote neutral. And the United States has never been neutral because the United States has always supported Israel and been more sympathetic to Israel. And every poll since the founding of the State of Israel has found that most Americans sympathize with Israelis. Now, having said that, this support for Israel does give the United States a certain amount of leverage on the Israelis whenever they have negotiations. And this leverage has led to other peace agreements, including the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty and the Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty. So I don't think that the fact that the United States backs Israel is necessarily preventing an agreement. And I don't think that fact is lost on the Palestinian negotiators who welcome U.S. pressure on Israel, pressure that can only take place in the context of a friendly relationship such that Israel has with the United States.
But it's pretty clear, though, that Israeli policies have moved to the right over the years. In fact, former President Bill Clinton made a remark about that a while back, saying that perhaps the influx of Russians has changed the political equation in Israel. And of late, it seems that there's not just the hatred of Obama here amongst Republicans, but to some extent, I think that's extended to the Israeli right, hasn't it?
That's correct. Israel has definitely moved to the right. And Netanyahu has not hidden his preference for Republicans and for a Republican presidency, a Republican administration. He's had a very testy relationship with President Obama. I don't think that's any secret. And in 2012, he all but endorsed Obama's opponent, Mitt Romney, in the presidential election. So there's a kind of a misnomer in Israel that Obama is somehow anti-Israel. And I do think it's a misnomer because Obama has a very solid record, and this administration has probably provided Israel with more security defense assistance than any other administration in history.
Right, and getting rid of Syria's chemical weapons, which would have been a serious problem for Israel, was done by Obama, and yet he got vilified for it. But my sense is that Donald Trump is, if anybody has kept what they call the Obama derangement syndrome alive, it's been Donald Trump. He's the number one birther.
That's right.
Not to mention, you know, saying as often as possible hateful things about him. So
that's right.
It's going to be odd to see him up there speaking to AIPAC, and he's made it pretty clear that he finds that more important than a debate on Fox News.
Well, at this point, he may not also want to engage in a debate if it's just between him and Ted Cruz, or perhaps Kasich as well, I guess, would be part of that debate. I'm not sure he needs that debate.
No, I think he's in a very strong situation. So, well, just in the last couple of minutes, then, what are you hearing from Israel in terms of a Trump presidency?
Well, Israelis are not really in tune. They don't really understand American politics all that well. There was a poll in Israel asking Israelis who their preferred candidate was, and Hillary Clinton was number one, followed by Trump, a close second, and somebody like Marco Rubio was way down the list, even though Marco Rubio has had a very pro-Israel record in the Senate, but they don't really know who he is. So I'm not sure I think they're asking a lot of questions about who this Donald Trump is and how that would affect U.S.-Israel relations. But I'm willing to bet that Donald Trump is not going to be the next president of the United States.
Well, just in closing then, what's your bet on a two-state solution?
Well, the two-state solution is, in my opinion, the only viable solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And this is something that I've been writing about, and you alluded to the CNN piece I wrote in late January, in which I talked about how the Israeli security community, the overwhelming majority of former Israeli generals, you know, senior IDF officials, former IDF chiefs of staff and heads of military intelligence, former Mossad chiefs and Shin Bet chiefs, the vast majority of them support a two-state solution and have been very critical of the political establishment, i.e. Prime Minister Netanyahu and his right-wing government, for promoting the status quo, for trying to, quote-unquote, manage the conflict rather than trying to resolve it. And they have been pushing for a more active approach towards resolving the conflict. Now, I don't see this happening during the election year, because without the United States, there's not going to be a two-state solution. They're not going to we don't even see peace talks that have been frozen for almost 2 years now. But it's my hope that the Obama administration will, at the very least, indicate somehow what a framework for an agreement would look like, because Kerry did have a framework that was never quite released or publicized back when he did broker the peace talks. And some have suggested that the administration might actually go to the UN and put kind of an outline together in the form of a UN Security Council resolution. And that would enable the next president, whoever it is, to follow up and resume negotiations, because what's really important now is to keep the two-state solution alive. There's more and more indications that it's going to be more difficult to achieve as time goes on, A, because of growing concerns, frustrations, despair among Palestinians, B, because of just growing distrust between the two sides, and C, because of the settlements, which are expanding in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which make it more and more difficult for a two-state solution to be realized. So I think it's very important to keep it alive, and that's where I think the administration can come in and help the next administration follow up on it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Guy Ziv.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Guy Ziv, who's a professor at American University's School of International Service and director of the Israel National Security Project. He's the author of Why Hawks Become Doves, Shimon Peres and Foreign Policy Change in Israel. And he has a recent article at CNN, Don't Give Up on a Two-State Solution. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts and also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.